Russian airstrike. Photos used to stir horror around the world at Russia's alleged actions.
They asked me for an interview. I answered that I didn't want to be interviewed, but they explained that the photo with me was all over the world, so I had to give them some comments. But as I got to know later, they published only 30 seconds of that interview. They left only the piece where I was saying that there was an explosion and the windows fell out. But they left out my words where I said there was no airstrike.
Many Russians then accused her of being a staged actor. She wasn't. The photos were genuine and she received abuse from the Russian side. But she is more critical of the journalists who she said misrepresented her. And to me, she voiced no criticism of the Russian army, instead only criticizing Ukraine.
Mariana is from Makiivka in Donbass. She lived there until 2019 under Ukrainian shelling. She's now moved back with her daughter. She is a Russian citizen.
There are hardly any people left here waiting for Ukraine to return. There might have been more before, but as the civil population has been under constant shelling and been terrorized for almost 9 years, my personal opinion is, if they consider these territories to be theirs, they can gather their army and try to conquer them. If they can't, well, so be it. Under shelling, there have been hardly any military objects hit. Instead, civilian infrastructure damaged, schools and kindergartens.
Mariana's story is reminiscent of the famous picture of Omran during the conflict in Syria. His photo was used to stir outrage in the West against the Syrian government. It turned out that his family were not against the Syrian government. As the propaganda war between East and West increasingly intensifies, the images of innocent civilians are being used to stir outrage. Pictures, as they say, speak a thousand words. It is likely only a matter of time before another such image goes viral that turns out to not be all as it seems. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
In the 2020 presidential election campaign, Joe Biden made a full return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program, a key plank of his foreign policy promises. After 2 years in office, his report card on keeping that promise can only be given a failing grade. Not only has Biden not returned to the JCPOA, but he has constantly levied new sanctions on Iran and seems to have fully retained the maximum pressure policy of his predecessor.
For 2 years now, Biden and, you know, his team of foreign policy ghouls like Tony Blinken have refused to lift the illegal sanctions dating back to the Trump era. Trump illegally withdrew from the JCPOA, and they're refusing to lift those sanctions, which has made any negotiations with Iran impossible.
Biden had benefited from total control over Congress, but the Democratic Party lost control of the House of Representatives in the recent midterm elections. Low turnout and disillusionment with many unkept promises are often being cited as the main reasons for the Democrats' defeat. Last month, a top poll on foreign policy found that a whopping 79% of Americans want the United States to continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question was there such massive support. With Congress now divided and more conservative, most analysts say that even if Biden did genuinely pursue diplomacy, Congress would easily block the deal under the so-called Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act.
You know, the ball has been in the U.S.'s court for 2 years, and, you know, I can see no reason to believe that Biden or the U.S. is committed to the agreement or negotiating in good faith. All they've done is ask for more concessions from Iran. And actually, more recently, they seem a lot more interested in trying to destabilize the country by meddling in its affairs, its sovereign affairs, of course, referring to the recent protests.
With their recent accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Iran has significantly expanded their diplomatic cooperation with their non-Western allies. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
سلام شهیدان وطن an incident that caused Iranians a great deal of agony. Iranian mourners took part in the funeral procession of the victims of the terror attack in the city of Izeh in floods of tears. In addition to expressing their deepest sympathy with families of the victims, the participants also voiced their support for the Islamic Republic amid the enemy's efforts to destabilize the country.
We have taken part in this funeral procession to send a message to the U.S. and Israel. They must know that Iran is not alone. We support the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation. They cannot sow division in Iran by killing civilians. We will be victorious.
My fellow countrymen and dear people of Izeh, be sure that the Islamic Republic is strong and will definitely take revenge for the blood that has been shed by all the cruel enemies who are servants of the criminal government of the United States.
Also, a number of high-ranking state and military officials attended the funeral, vowing to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice as soon as possible.
The perpetrators of this crime will be punished. A number of them have been arrested, while some others have been identified. Some of them attempted to flee the country through border crossings. However, they have been arrested. We will inform the Iranian nation about arresting the rest of the perpetrators in the coming days.
Officials say so far 11 individuals who've been involved in Izeh terrorist attack have been detained. Seven people, including a 9-year-old child and a woman, were killed, while 11 others were wounded after gunmen started shooting at people in the center of the city.
The terrorist attack was completely pre-planned. The terrorists broke the cameras across the city by shooting at them 24 hours prior to the attack. Then the next day, they opened fire at people at a crossroad from two directions. Their goal was to cause a massive bloodshed.
As they said, the enemies cannot turn Iran to another Syria or Lebanon by carrying out violent acts like the ones in Shah Cheragh, Isfahan, and Izeh.
Iranian officials have strongly condemned the recent terror attacks in the country. They say the enemies of the Islamic Republic have now resorted to armed terror attacks that target civilians because they have failed to advance their anti-Iran agenda through creating media hype. Mahdi Abbasian, Izeh, Khuzestan.
The trailer released on Thursday for the documentary movie From Tehran to Tirana is so powerful in its message about the MKO and its practices that it leaves no room for doubting why every defector that has managed to flee insists on calling it a cult where members are required to demonstrate complete devotion to its leader.
Ever since I joined the MKO in Iraq and I realized that they had lied about everything, I wanted to leave, but it was almost impossible. Finally, when we were relocated to Albania, I found the opportunity to escape. Many inside the camp are not as lucky as me.
The movie is inspired by a book of the same name written by a defector who managed to escape the camp 2 decades ago and who has dedicated his life to raising public awareness about the MKO.
Nejat NGO was founded by a number of defectors about 15 years ago. Our mission is to reunite families with their loved ones and help defectors escape. We also try to raise awareness about this cult and how they recruit people.
Leaving the camp is almost impossible. I was recruited when I was a prisoner of war in Iraq. I was told that they would help me go home. I later found out that Saddam had allowed this. And also I met members who had come to Camp Ashraf with false promises of employment or asylum in Western countries and brought into Iraq illegally. We were all asked to submit our passports and ID cards, which effectively trapped us there.
The movie also highlights the new methods of recruitment through social media platforms by the MKO's so-called keyboard warriors, a group of about 300 MKO members who run fake social media accounts.
Parents should be very careful. They are now using new methods to recruit the younger generation. They asked these young people to go out on the streets and take part in riots and send them pictures and videos.
This is not the first time the MKO is using social media to advance its agenda. Previous reports by other TV channels has also revealed their strategy.
Should comment by the different account and not MKO members, Mujahideen, because we want to show the Iranian people support Maryam Rajavi.
So you were a troll?
Yes.
You were an internet troll?
Yes.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, is a known terrorist organization. It has killed more than 17,000 Iranians over the past 43 years, and now it is actively involved in riots in Iran by instigating the younger generation through social media to carry out acts of vandalism. The best way to counter this terrorist organization is to raise public awareness, and this is the main focus of the movie. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled, savings depleted, hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights. And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries. This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas with when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra costs to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, a launch which comes after a series of missile launches lately.
Now, in response to American B-1B bombers were redeployed to the Korean Peninsula to conduct joint drills with South Korea. Both North Korea and the U.S., with its allies, are not backing down from their stances. The North firing missiles and the U.S. and its allies conducting military drills, which North Korea sees as a rehearsal for invasion. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S., which has strangled North Korea with sanctions, has chosen a military approach towards nuclear-armed North Korea instead of diplomacy. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joins us from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, Jeff Brown. He is a geopolitical analyst who joins us from Normandy. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Jeff Brown, I'll first start with you. We're looking at a missile launch, this intercontinental ballistic missile launch, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, a Hwasong-17, which is dubbed by analysts as a monster missile. It comes after a series of missile tests that North has conducted lately. Why do you think North Korea is launching so many missiles at this point in time?
The situation in Korea, we need to go back to the ceasefire in 1953. The United States has stalled and refused to sign an armistice with North Korea. They resisted from day one. The United States has 73 military bases in South Korea, a country the size of Switzerland, and 30,000 troops. They recently got caught. The United States recently got caught releasing bioweapons in South Korea. They have a lot of reasons to be. It's just not something recent. This has been going on since 1953, and they remember what happened to Iraq after they got rid of their chemical weapons, and they remember what happened to Libya after Libya got rid of its weapons of mass destruction. Of course, both of the countries were destroyed by the United States. So the North Koreans want to make sure that everybody understands that they are not Libya and Iraq.
Okay. Well, we're looking at the reaction from the U.S., in this case, in point William Jones, which has been a typical reaction, and that is two American B-1B bombers that were redeployed to the Korean Peninsula in what was then joint drills with South Korea's military. And, of course, North Korea sees that as not only a provocation, but also, in the bigger picture, a rehearsal for invasion. Well, here's a thought. Why doesn't the U.S. stop these military drills and instead use diplomacy or talks instead?
Well, I think the attitude now today is to play hardball on all of these so-called geopolitical situations. You got to look at the international context now is that the U.S. has defined a policy effectively of bringing down, at least cutting down Russia to a lower size today to cease it being a major power. Now, also, the attacks on China were restricting its development as a major player on the international arena. There have been backs and forth on this. The recent talks between Biden and Xi seem to be encouragement, but the general trend is in the opposite direction. North Korea sees this. North Korea, I think, wants to become a nuclear power. They feel that that's the only way they can really protect themselves. Nevertheless, they have shown a certain compromise, certain ability to compromise if there were moves from the Western side to do it during the Trump administration in particular. And I think they would as well. But now they see that the U.S. and its so-called allies are moving to really take control over world politics. They're trying to isolate China and Russia, and that North Korea is using that opportunity to show what it can do. The fact that there is no serious attempts or serious cooperation by the U.S. and China to work together on this, they feel that their position is relatively strong in terms of the international situation, and they can incur these provocations. And the problem is the U.S. seems to be going up against this with more provocations, which is going to only escalate the situation entirely.
All right. So you said it there. Jeff Brown, our guest, said it, escalate the situation. Our guest also said that the U.S. is playing hardball. How do you see that approach? I mean, We're talking about not only the, I think there was 25 missile tests in one day, and this intercontinental ballistic missile, which, by the way, can reach the U.S. mainland. You're playing fire with somebody, in this case in point, Kim Jong-un's sister, who has likened the U.S. to a barking dog seized with fear, pushing the Korean Peninsula towards a crisis of which she obviously warned of the toughest counter action. And as I mentioned in my first question to you, this missile called the Hwasong-17 is dubbed by analysts as the monster missile. If I were the U.S., I would think twice about playing with fire, as the former U.S. presidents, U.S. President Donald Trump mentioned.
Well, what's even more ridiculous about the American position is, I'm sure that the Biden should know and the Pentagon should know that China and North Korea have a mutual defense treaty that they signed in 1961. It is still in effect. In fact, they renewed it a few years ago. And that's the only country that China has a mutual defense treaty with, and that's the only country that North Korea has a mutual defense treaty with. So if there is a conflagration on the Korean Peninsula, China is also the enemy, and they would be honor-bound to defend Korea just like they did during the Korean War. And so this is, empires, this is like the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire or the Greek Empire, and they have lizard brains. They have reptile brains. They can only think of projecting, total dominance and total control. And I think that's what we're seeing today. I don't think anything will ever happen. But what's scary about all this is, what if there is a sort of the Cuban Missile Crisis or something like that, where there's a misunderstanding and the United States thinks that North Korea has shot a missile, or vice versa, the United States to North Korea. That's what's so scary about all this, is that if there's an accident or a misunderstanding, it could result in a major war.
Okay, this point that you mentioned is a very important point, and I'm wondering, William Jones, how China would react were there to be an attack on the DPRK, where our guest talked about a mutual defense treaty. Can you tell us about that, if that still holds true, as our guest said, that it does? That, in a sense, it kind of mirrors what NATO has, doesn't it, in terms of, if one of its members were attacked with Article 5 to be triggered?
Well, it certainly, the treaty certainly is still intact. How the Chinese would react is still an open question. They would feel, that was an attack against them. We know it took them a while to make a decision on during the Korean War. They didn't themselves encourage Kim Il-sung to move to the south. But once this did happen, and once the U.S. began to move all the way to the border with China, the Chinese were prepared to intervene on that. And at what point they would do that in terms of an attack on North Korea is hard to say, but they could not let that go by without some political and military action on their part. This is their neighborhood. North Korea is their neighbor, not always as controllable as one would like, but it is there, and they feel that they should work together with them. And that's why they have been pushing the entire time in response to the more flagrant missile launches by Kim Jong-un over the recent period, telling the United States that they have got to come to some kind of discussion. They've got to meet them halfway, North Korea, that is, in terms of what they feel are their own security concerns. And there has been no response on that from the United States. And I think China will push as much as they can, but if it leads to military conflict, then really all bets are off.
Okay. Well, the U.S. is blaming Russia and China on a couple fronts here, Jeff Brown. One of them is at the U.N. in terms of the veto, obviously. The other is that U.S. says China and Russia, they have leverage over North Korea. They can stop North Korea in their minds in terms of the missile test that's happening. And I'm curious as to how and why they would think that would be the case. And if they wanted that to be the case, Why are they having such a militaristic approach, not only towards China, but towards Russia especially, given what's happening in Ukraine?
That also brings up a good point. North Korea and China have most of the common border, but up in the very far north east corner, Russia has a common border with North Korea also. It's only 12 kilometers, but they have a railroad and road. And it's also hard to imagine that if there was some kind of a conflagration on the peninsula, China, I think, would be honor-bound. Well, because they didn't want MacArthur, you know, going up to the Yalu River in 1950, and they sure don't want him. They sure don't want the United States to have nuclear missiles on the Yalu River today. So that would likely really put Russia in a very, very difficult situation, sharing a common border. I find this a lot of posturing, and this is the typical behavior of empires. I remember Boutros Ghali, the former secretary general of the United Nations, in his private papers after he retired, said that empires don't do diplomacy. And the Roman Empire didn't do diplomacy. And he said the United States is an empire, and it doesn't do diplomacy either. It simply wants to frighten, force. It's all about force.
Okay. We're having problems.
United States.
I'm sorry, we're having problems with your connection there. Well, let's move on to maybe what other motives the U.S. may have here, William Jones. That may be just money. Maybe the U.S. is a war profiteer, because we're looking, kind of in a sense, what it's doing with countries in Europe when it comes to Ukraine, making scaremongering them into the fact that Russia has done what it's done to Ukraine. And you may be next. And in this area of the world, it may be doing the same with those countries. For example, when it comes to arms sales, recently, when there was a missile test, Japan is now intimidated, wants to double its military budget. And the government next month is going to propose doubling their defense budget over the next decade. And it's going to include acquiring acquisitions of long-range strike-type missiles. Or weapons, I should say. Do you think that is a goal maybe the U.S. has? Because we know it does that to Taiwan also.
Well, that it's certainly fueling the machine. I can tell you that. I don't think it's as simple as seeing that they're making money by conducting the war. They are doing that, but the reason they're conducting the war is because of the mindset. And the mindset is not making money. Maintaining power, maintaining unilateral power over the so-called rules of the road. And of course, you've got a situation today, you know, people talk about the Thucydides trap, which is, you know, a lot of it's not accurate. But the fact of the matter is that the world is changing in such a way that powers like China and also powers like Russia feel that they ought to have a say in how the world is governed. And rightly they should, given their size, given the population in China, especially not only the population, but the economic power, number two economic power in the world, the biggest trading country in the world, should have something to say over that. And maybe it's different than what the United States thinks. But we're not in a situation that, as we did have after the fall of the Soviet Union, where the U.S. basically is calling the shots. And the United States politicians, the political elites, don't realize that this requires a change of the governance model, which includes those countries, which now are major powers, to come to agreements on the rules of the road. And that is the biggest problem, that Biden is really kind of living in the days of the post-Cold War period. And he wants to go back there, but the reality on the ground is much different. And they can go as far as creating a war or the danger of nuclear war, which, of course, is occurring now, that danger, as everybody knows, in the situation in Ukraine. But they will not realize their goals, but they may realize the end of humanity as a result of that. So there's no exit to this except changing the mindset and accepting the fact that these countries, these major powers in particular, have got to get together and resolve their issues diplomatically and not on the battlefield.
Well, how is that going to come about, Jeff Brown? And we take a look at the U.S. in terms of the way that its approach towards Ukraine has been fueled by provocation towards Russia, which, you know, every so often, and maybe even more now, we're hearing about the possibility of nuclear weapons being used. So that's on the one hand. And then you have this situation that's unfolding in the Korean Peninsula, again, with North Korea having nuclear weapons that may be used. The common factor here, in a sense, is the U.S. Do you think that the U.S. is teetering on this issue for geopolitical gains? But then, does that make any sense?
Well, I think William is right. I always like to use the metaphor. You know, the Western leaders have reptile brains, and they can only go in one direction: attack, dominate, occupy, exploit. I mean, this is the mentality, and the United States is top dog in the West, essentially NATO, along with Australia. And I don't see them changing. President Trump did try to make some peace with North Korea, but he was obviously sideswiped by bureaucrats and other people around him. He was pretty well sabotaged in trying to do something, but you know, Lord knows he did try. Unless there's a change in 2024, and maybe Trump gets back in the White House, I don't see anything changing. I mean, Ukraine. You know, we've got Yemen, we've got Syria, we've got Iran, we've got North Korea. We've got it just goes on and on and on. And full spectrum dominance, that's what they want. They want full spectrum dominance on everybody who is a perceived enemy. And unfortunately, that's most of the world that anybody that disagrees, Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, Argentina, now Lula in Brazil. We'll see what happens there. The U.S. I think is unhinged, and it's a very, very dangerous situation. But I've got my fingers crossed that we'll be okay.
Yeah, we had 4 minutes left to the program. Maybe we could have continued with that, but that's okay. All right. So, William Jones, what are we looking at here? If there is to be a breakthrough, if we want to put certain aspects of the world where the U.S. is engaged, along with its attitude of world dominance, but it's not proving to be successful. The situation in particular, the topic of our program, the Korean Peninsula situation, is really escalating in the way that it is based on what we have seen with the missile launches. So North Korea is not backing down. Is there a big exchange or a give and take that needs to take place here? Or are we simply looking at the North Korean case that sanctions, there needs to be concessions given, for example, when it comes to sanctions, which it doesn't seem like the U.S. is even open to discuss that at this point?
Well, first of all, there would have to be talks between the two parties, which, of course, aren't taking place anytime soon. But I think the reality is that what you will see is that the concentration of all these crises is already leading to popular revolt in Europe, and to a lesser extent also here in the United States, although I think we'll see more and more of this as the economic situation declines as a result of these policies. And even politicians who have a certain mindset know the reality of elections and the revolts and people out on the street demonstrating. I think that is going to turn the minds, first of all, of a lot of the European leaders who have been on this, on board this policy, but are very reticent about it, as well as here in the United States. You're going to see a lot more turmoil as the dust settles over the midterm elections. And I think it's only in that condition, those conditions, that there will be a shift of a mindset, because reality on the ground has changed for these political elites. How that will affect North Korea, I think there's going, it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I think there will be more backs and forth, more tit for tat in terms of the reaction on both sides. But at some point, I think even other countries, including China, will probably intervene a little more forcefully on the diplomatic issue, now that there is communication between the United States and China at various levels, to try and find a solution where the U.S. would at least agree to open some talks with the North Koreans, because as, mm-hmm. as it's going now, it will only lead to conflict.
Well, Jeff Brown, our guest, William Jones, talks about how there is, as he just said, communication between China and the U.S. Really, I mean, is that a, some kind of breakthrough of any sense, or ultimately the U.S. is still really after China and wants this zone or this area, this region, the Korean Peninsula, to be militarized, because ultimately wants to go after China. So it's going to keep on with the arms sales of all the allies and trying to break through, especially when it comes to the area of trade, like we saw with the push in ASEAN recently, where it presented a strategic partnership to the ASEAN countries, wants to pull those countries into its sphere. So when it has these countries by its side, the ultimate goal being China, it can go after China more easily. Or is that a correct window to look at when it comes to this?
Well, of course, the United States wants to destroy Russia first, because the ultimate target is China. China is the ultimate country that they want to conquer and dominate because of its massive economy. In PPP terms, it's already been the number one economy since 2014. Even the World Bank says that. And I do want to say this, we cannot forget that, remember Bill Clinton and North Korea and how they had all this great cooperation going, and both sides made a good faith effort. And then George Bush, you know, got into office, and then North Korea suddenly became a member of the Axis of Evil. So we have to understand that the North Koreans have every right to be cynical and not believe anything that the Americans say. But again, maybe with a change in the White House in 2024, it might happen.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. That's Jeff Brown, geopolitical analyst from Normandy. Thank you so much. And William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review from Washington, D.C. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetäväinen and the team, it's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
Grand declarations at COP27 on tackling the climate emergency are sabotaged by a treaty from the 1990s that sees European nations held to ransom by the energy companies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Europe's dirtiest secret, one deterring it from seriously and rapidly tackling the climate emergency, is not being addressed at COP27, the United Nations Climate Change Conference hosted by Egypt. Mention of the Energy Charter Treaty would expose how far Western states, the biggest greenhouse gas polluters, are from being in a position to cut carbon emissions in half by 2030. Failure to do so sets the world on course for catastrophic global warming above 1.5 degrees Celsius. Whatever grand declarations they issue at the summit in Sharm el-Sheikh concludes, the reality is that the European states effectively tied their hands for the foreseeable future by ratifying the Energy Treaty back in 1990s. They have landed themselves with a massive financial burden if they try to cut emissions. Europe would rather not admit it has made itself the prisoner of transnational energy corporations. The firms can hold member states to ransom for compensation, frustrating European efforts to significantly change energy policies for at least the next two decades. The treaty's stipulations help to explain why, despite years of climate pledges, the latest research shows fossil fuel emissions are set to hit a record high by the end of this year. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, told world leaders at COP, "We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator. Our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible." The Energy Charter Treaty is one of the main drivers propelling Europe down that highway, further dissuading Europe from publicly addressing problems with the energy treaty is the fact that it would highlight tensions over energy policy with Russia that are at the root of the current crisis. It might even provide a crucial piece of the puzzle in trying to understand who was behind the sabotage of the two Nord Stream pipelines supplying Russian gas directly to Germany and why. The pipelines were blown up by an unknown party or parties in October. Instead, there continues to be a conspiracy of silence over the energy treaty and its effects. The failure to push for its abolition at COP27 will undermine any declarations of progress on addressing the climate crisis. The Energy Charter Treaty came into being shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Energy firms lobbied for its adoption to secure long-term investments exploiting fossil energy resources in the former Soviet Union, in case these newly independent states later switched their industries back to public ownership. Corporations were given the right to sue any treaty member that changed its energy policy in ways that might harm their profits. Even if states pull out of the treaty, a sunset clause means they are still liable to lost claims for an additional 20 years. Hearings are made in secret at the special international tribunals. The European Union and individual European states, including the UK, are among the more than 50 states that have ratified the treaty. There has been mounting concern in Europe, however, at its impact on their plans for a green transition. Italy pulled out in 2015, and in a major development, Germany announced recently its intention to quit so. Spain, France, Poland, and the Netherlands have threatened to follow. Other contracting parties include
Turkey, Japan, and states in Central Asia. Despite its obvious drawbacks, the treaty is being pushed aggressively at Africa, the West Asia, Latin America, and Asia, with the promise of new energy investments. It will become harder to reduce these countries' carbon emissions the moment they sign up. The United States is an observer to the treaty, but not subject to its provisions. Russia signed the treaty, but never ratified it. Nonetheless, arbitrators at a special tribunal ruled that it is still liable. Although the trade pact is a legacy of distrust stemming from the Cold War, energy corporations have repurposed it in recent years as a tool for obstructing European efforts to go green. States face a stark choice. Either give in to corporate bullying to stick with fossil fuels or face massive compensation suits, valued at hundreds of billions of pounds, for shifting to renewable energy supplies. Even the move to renewables by Europe entails major risks under the treaty, as the science around green energy constantly evolves and regulations change with it. Any amendment to energy supply risks, triggering a spate of compensation suits, had, for example, Britain's former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn won the 2019 general election, his government could have faced a series of crushing damages claims if it had implemented its manifesto commitment to nationalize the UK's energy sector. Similarly, states could be sued if they try to take measures to curb fuel poverty or impose energy windfall taxes. Similarly, states could be sued if they try to take measures to curb fuel poverty or impose energy windfall taxes. Concerns about Europe's ability to meet its 2015 Paris Agreement targets, designed to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, have grown as fossil fuel firms have scored a string of victories at the treaty's special tribunals. Among the hardest hit in Spain, which already faces damages claims of 10 billion euros, the Netherlands has risked a legal backlash over its plans to phase out coal, and Italy, even outside the treaty, is being sued under the Sunset Clause for its ban on oil and gas drilling in the Adriatic. In August, a tribunal awarded the UK oil firm Rockhopper 120 million pounds in damages over Italy's moves to become greener. A 2020 study suggested total energy investments protected by the treaty amounted to some 1.3 trillion euros, far above the $630 billion estimated to have been invested globally in climate action in 2020. Potential compensation claims will continue to grow under the treaty, and damages will have to be paid in addition to expenditure on renewables. It would be hard to deny that these astronomical compensation sums are creating a decisive regulatory chill, dissuading governments from phasing out fossil fuels and switching to renewables for fear of being sued. Energy firms are rushing in to fill the void. New research has found that they are massively expanding exploration for additional sources of fossil fuel, spending $160 billion over the past 2 years. The International Energy Agency has warned that the world cannot avoid climate catastrophe unless there is a moratorium on the opening of new oil and gas fields. That may explain why there were a record number of fossil fuel lobbyists at COP27, more than the combined delegations of the 10 countries facing the biggest impacts from the climate emergency.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.